You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, so if you've been with our study in 1 Samuel, we've been studying through the book of 1 Samuel. This is ancient history of the nation of Israel. We're reading things that happened over 3,000 years ago. We've been reading about a guy named David and a guy named Saul have been two of our main characters in this book. And God has picked this dude named David to be the next king. He picked him as a shepherd boy in the fields. He was thrust into the limelight we saw a couple of weeks ago as he defeated Goliath. And then we saw King Saul, the actual current king. He's growing increasingly paranoid and homicidal. We saw last week he tries to kill David no fewer than 9 different times. He's trying to hang on to the kingship. He's trying to preserve his dynasty, even though God has said, look, I've picked somebody else. Well, last week at the end of our time together, we saw David was torn away from his closest friends. He's torn away from his wife. He's torn away from his mentor, a guy named Samuel. He's torn away from his best friend, a man named Jonathan. And David has to go on the run out into the wilderness. And now he faces life in the wilderness. We come to a period in David's life for 1 Samuel 21 through 28 or so that takes probably a decade or more, perhaps 15 years. And so there's not a lot of time indicators given, but the years are rolling by as he spends time out here in the wilderness. And I don't know if you've ever like gone camping and the camping trip lasted just a little bit too long for your liking and you're like, I'm ready to get back, okay? Well, David's like, 15 years here. And he is really starting to get to him after a while. But now he faces life in the wilderness, a pretty rugged terrain out in ancient Israel. But God is in control the whole time. God is going to fulfill his plan to make David king just at the right time. God is going to use this suffering to prepare David for the throne. He's making him into a dynamic spiritual leader through this suffering in his life. And God will bring new friends into David's life as well, just when he needs them. But now David must wait on God. And waiting on God, I don't know if anyone here is having to wait on anything right now. You feel like you're waiting on God and you've been waiting and waiting and waiting and the weeks have turned into months and the months are starting to turn into years and you're wondering, where is God? Well, David knows how you feel. Some of us are suffering. We're not just waiting. We're waiting and we're in pain and we're waiting for the pain to be relieved. Maybe it's relational pain. Maybe it's physical pain, financial, economic pain. Bad things are happening around us and God seems to do nothing. Where is God? Well, David saw this as well. We feel like our pain is someone else's fault. Well, David definitely felt like this. He could pin this right on one man, King Saul. And yet, he's got a little bit of a different attitude than I think a lot of us would have. We wonder, how do we deal with the stress and the unknowns of where are we going next? What is happening next? We see all of this from David, and we're going to try to learn something here as we look at this period in his life. Well, he's moving around a lot. I just want to give you a sense of the map here. This is a map of ancient Israel, and the area that David is going to be in, it's this area right here. If you blew this up, it'd be about 100 miles square. If you think about, Mount Gilead, Mount Vernon, those are 40 and 50 miles here from Columbus. And so this would be sort of moving around an area kind of central and northeast Ohio. And David's going to be moving around, sometimes alone, sometimes with a large group of hundreds of men. And he's going to be hiding from King Saul through all of this. And so the first place that David runs after he departs from Jonathan, as we saw at the end of last week, is he flees to a town named Nob, which is right next to Jerusalem. David went to the town of Nob to see Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he saw him. Why are you alone? He can tell something's wrong. Something's not right. He doesn't know the whole details that Saul has made it very public that he's trying to kill David, and that David has run from Saul. But David is kind of honest with him, and yet he's not honest with him. He says, well, the king has sent me on a private matter. Now, if the king is God, then I guess you could say that's true. But he's not straightforward with him, and it ends up having some pretty horrific consequences. David says, what is there to eat? I'm starving. All they had was the holy bread for the tabernacle, and since there was no other food available, the priest gave him the sacred bread. Now Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief herdsman, was there that day, and so we get a little note in our narrative that says Doeg was there witnessing this whole thing, and this also becomes very important later in our narrative. But he's witnessing this. This guy works for Saul. This guy's loyal to Saul. David then asked Ahimelech the priest, "Do you have a spear or a sword? I'm going to need a weapon." And Ahimelech says, "I have the sword of Goliath the Philistine," the guy that David had slain a few chapters ago. David says, "There's nothing like it. Give it to me." And so David escaped from Saul and went to King Achish of Gath. So he takes the bread, he takes the sword, and he decides, my best bet is to go and live with the Philistines. Maybe I can blend in among them there. Well, he gets to Gath. So David flees to Gath. But the officers of Achish were unhappy about David's being there. They said, isn't this David the king of the land? Isn't he the one that people honor with dances and that song about how David has slain 10,000s? Well, David heard these comments, and he was very afraid of what King Achish of Gath might do to him. He goes to the Philistines, you know, this army that he has done battle with for on behalf of Israel. He tries to blend in. He realizes, I'm caught. The king knows I'm here. The king knows who I am. This is very scary. And so what does David do? How does David respond to this threat on his life? Well, I think he does what any normal person would do. It says David pretended to be insane. He began scratching on doors and drooling on his beard. And King Achish is like, must you bring me a madman? This is no great warrior. We already have enough madmen around here. Do we not have enough crazy people in Gath? And so he sends him on his way. So David escapes, and yet what we see on the surface only shows part of the story, as is so often the case in the history of David. We see what he does. But when we cross-reference this with the Psalms, we see there were two different Psalms that David wrote during this time in his life. And what a time this was. He's just fled. He's on his own. And we turn to David's journal, and we see him writing, "Oh God, have mercy on me, for people are hounding me. My foes attack me all day long, but when I am afraid, I will put my trust in you. I trust in God, so why should I be afraid? What can mere mortals do to me?" And so what do we see here? David, he's crying out to God. He says, people are hounding me. I'm being attacked. I'm afraid. He's being honest with God about his feelings. But then, as we move down through the psalm, David moves over onto truth. He says, you know what? I trust in God. I don't need to be afraid. Mere mortals cannot do anything to me if the God of the universe doesn't want them to. We read Psalm 34 again. He wrote during this time. In Gath, he says, "I prayed to Yahweh and he answered me. He freed me from all of my fears." He says, "I was so scared and I took my fears to God." Do you know how to take your fears to God? Do you know how to lay those at his feet? And then he says, as he works down through his feelings, he says, you know what? Yahweh, God, he is close to the brokenhearted. The brokenhearted, what a great statement. The righteous person faces many troubles, but Yahweh comes to the rescue each time. Are you brokenhearted here tonight? Are you like David? David was lonely, and David was brokenhearted here. He everywhere he turns, people are after him, and he's all alone. And we see that he flees then to a cave, the cave of Adullam. He left Gath, he escaped to the cave of Adullam, and this was perhaps the loneliest time in David's life. I don't know if there was a worse time for him. David is reaching a point where he hits rock bottom. His support structure is torn away. His wife, his best friend, his mentor. And what will David do during this time? We see David again turns to his journal. Psalm 57, this psalm was written at this time. We have David documenting his journey for us and then sharing those with everyone. He says, "God, have mercy on me, have mercy. I look to you for protection. I will hide beneath the shadow of your wings until the danger passes by." What a tender image that is. You imagine the bird with the baby little, you know, birdies, right? And the mom is just kind of putting that wing over the bird. And David said, that's how I feel. You know, he's a mighty warrior. He's slain the Philistine giant in front of all of Israel. But now he's so scared. And he says, "God, I cannot protect myself anymore." Do you ever get to the point where you've just come to the end of yourself and you're like, "I can't protect myself. I can't handle this anymore." David is hitting that point. David has hit that point. All the people he could turn to, they're not there anymore. And he says, as everything is stripped away from him and the weeks turn into months, David turns to God and he says, "God, I feel like the helpless little bird, but I want to huddle right up underneath the protection of your wings until the danger passes by. He says, I cry out to God Most High, to God who will fulfill his purpose for me. So he's crying out. You ever cry out to God? You ever show? I think we're too theologically correct in our prayers. I think we're like, yes, Lord, I feel the right thing. I am Faithbot 3000. And that's not what David's doing here. Some of these psalms, it's like a splash of water in the face. We need to learn how to be honest with God. We can't just jump straight to the truth. We start with how we feel, and we express that to God, like David is doing here. He's crying out. He feels so vulnerable. But as he does this, and he begins to connect with God, to review God's truth, he says, you know, I trust that God will fulfill his purpose for me. What was that purpose? He's going to protect me until I'm king. And he says, my heart is confident in you, O God. So we see him coming to a place of confidence, a place of stability. In Psalm 142, he again writes this at the same time in his life. What a time this was in the cave. He says, you are my place of refuge. You are all I really want in life. One of the great gifts that David receives from God during this time, and one of the great gifts that you can receive through suffering, is you can see when everything is stripped away, you can see what is really important. You can see what you really need. Do you want to have this kind of a relationship with God? This is what God wants. God is not the pagan God who sits there and we have to do some ritual to get him to give us what we want. No, God is a God of love. And God wants this close relationship with you. And David is finding this here. He's finding this. And then as David is alone in the cave at the end of himself, something amazing begins to happen. He hears footsteps outside the cave. And people begin to trickle in. God begins to call people out to him in the wilderness. I don't know how they knew he was there. But God begins to send people to David. His friendships have been stripped away. And now God sends new friends into his life. In fact, it says his brothers and all his other relatives joined with him there. All we've seen from David's family so far is dysfunction. His dad won't even acknowledge he's his son. He leaves him out in the field when Samuel calls the brothers in. His brothers are mocking him. They're jealous of him. He's the one who's anointed king. And so we see this dysfunctional family. God brings healing out in the wilderness. His brothers, they leave Saul's army and they say, David, we're with you. You are God's man. You're the one that God has picked. You are the next king. People like his nephew Joab, who becomes a very important player later in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, may have joined up with David right during this time. But it's not just his family. Other men begin to trickle in. Others begin coming out to the wilderness, out to the cave of Adullam. Men who are in trouble or who are in debt, not happy with society, the rejects, the losers. And eventually David became the captain of 400 men. You know, these men, these were the rejects of society. These were the people that society didn't want. And yet these men become famous. These rejects, these become perhaps the most famous group of soldiers in the history of the world, David's mighty men. And not only did they become soldiers who fought for David, who bled with David, but they became David's best friends. These became his support network out there in the wilderness. And God was forming a group here. He was forming friendships. These would play key roles, not just in David's wilderness time, but in David's future government. God was calling these men together. These were men that never would have had access to David if he had remained in the palace, but these were people God had called. And isn't it funny how God often picks losers and rejects? You ever notice how often that works? You look at the life of Christ, he was like a magnet for losers. The people who society hated, these are the ones that came to Christ. He got criticism from the elite, from the religious leaders. And Jesus said, look, a doctor doesn't come to people who think they're healthy. He comes to people who know they're sick. And that's the kind of people God is looking for. One, because, you know, when the world is applauding you, it's hard to see your need for God. But two, because when God takes a loser and raises them up and does something cool through them, then everybody can see this is God who did this. When God takes losers like me and maybe like some of you here, it becomes all the more obvious that he is a great and mighty God. Do you know personally the God who, as Hannah said earlier in this book, who lifts the needy from the garbage dump and sets them among princes? You know, you ever like, you ever peer down in the McDonald's trash can? Recently, I was there, accidentally threw my cup away, wanted to refill, and I kind of like, I lift the thing, I look down in there, and I'm like, you know what? Once it's in the McDonald's trash can, it's gone. I'm not getting that thing out of there. But you know what God does is God goes, he doesn't just look in the trash. He goes out to the dumpster behind McDonald's and he starts picking through it. And there he finds you. And God says, you know what? I think I can do something with this loser. I think I can do something with this person. Because God is the God of grace. And this is what we see here. We see God gathering the rejects of society, picking the most unlikely, and doing something great through them. Just like he did with David. Just like he can do with you. Jesus Christ died on the cross so that you could be rescued by God. Will you receive that forgiveness? Well, David has to flee again now. He realizes a cave is no place for my parents. They're old. I need somewhere for them to stay. And so he goes across the border. He goes to the nation of Moab, which was east of the Dead Sea. And he asks the king, can you please allow my father and mother to live here with you? Now, David's great-grandma was a woman named Ruth, who was an awesome woman. You can read about her in the book of Ruth. She was a Moabitess. She was from Moabite. She was from Moab. She was a Moabite. So David was like, you know, one-eighth Moabite. He's going to be the next king of Israel. And so he calls in a favor. He says, can my family stay with you until I know what God is going to do for me? What a statement of faith. Well, it appears that the king of Moab agrees to hold not just his parents, but he allows David and his men to stay there for a while in some sort of a stronghold. And so they have food to eat. They have a bed to sleep in. They have a king that doesn't want to kill him. But then God sends the prophet Gad out to Moab. And he tells David, you need to leave this stronghold and return to the land of Judah. And David's like, why can't I stay in a bed? Why can't I stay where there's food and a king that's not trying to kill me? And God says, no, you've got to go back into the wilderness. And so he sends him and his men back in. And he flees to Judah. Now, the news of David's arrival in Judah soon reached King Saul. Not good. At the time, the king was sitting beneath the tamarisk tree on the hill at Gibeah, his hometown. And as usual, Saul is holding his spear, surrounded by his officers. Listen here, you men of Benjamin, Saul shouted to his officers when he heard the news about David. Has that son of Jesse promised every one of you fields and vineyards? Is that why you've conspired against me? Not one of you told me when my son, my own son, made a solemn pact with the son of Jesse. You're not even sorry for me. The better person creates their own reality. They see everything through a bitter lens. Saul's the one trying to kill David, not the other way around. And yet he thinks everyone is against him. Well, there's an awkward silence from Saul's officers because they don't know anything about a conspiracy. And then finally, a voice breaks through the awkward silence. Doeg the Edomite, who was standing there, spoke up. When I was at Nob, I saw that son of Jesse chalking to the priest. He gave him food. He gave him a sword. I saw it all, King Saul. Saul is furious. He immediately calls for the priests. He sent for Ahimelech and all of his family. And when they arrived, Saul shouted at them, "You listen to me, you son of a high tub!" That was his dad. "Oh, what is it, my king?" Ahimelech asked. "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me?" He keeps asking people that. Everything's a conspiracy to some people. "But, sir, is anyone among all your servants as faithful as David? I mean, he's your son-in-law. He's married to your daughter, right? Right? I knew nothing of any plot against you." But with Saul, the facts don't matter. He's already made his judgment. "You will surely die, Ahimelech, along with your entire family," the king shouted. And he ordered his bodyguards, "Kill these priests." Now that's messed up. Saul's soldiers, they don't know what to do. And so they just stand there, not doing anything. They refuse to kill these holy men wearing their priestly garments. They're just standing there. No. So Saul then turns to Doeg and says, "Why don't you do it?" "Gladly." So Doeg the Edomite turned on the priests and he killed them that day. 85 priests in all. A massacre. And he doesn't stop there. He goes to Nob, the town of the priests, and he kills the priests' families. A genocide, a massacre of hundreds of innocent people. And you know, in our like peaceful culture, this is so shocking. But you know what? In a lot of parts of the world, this is not that uncommon. This is the kind of agony and evil that they have to deal with. We see this happening on the news right now. We see this happening in places like Israel, even today. We see massacre of innocents. It's sickening. It's nauseating. And we see how far Saul has fallen here. Only Abiathar, one of the sons of Ahimelech, escaped and fled to David. And he told David what had happened, and David feels so horrible. He realizes, I'm partly to blame for this. This is because of me. Yeah, it was Saul, but it was me. David realizes, I got to be more careful. He says, "Stay here with me. Don't be afraid. I'll protect you with my own life." But David is just like, I can't even go to anybody for help anymore because I'm going to get him killed. I said it last week. I'll say it again. The Bible is an R-rated book. The violence in times like this, but it tells it like it is. And what do we do? Where does David turn in the face of such atrocity? Where is God? Why is God standing idly by while this evil is happening? Well, once again, David turns to his journal. Once again, David turns to God in prayer. And he prays a prayer of lament. He prays an angry prayer. We read Psalm 52 during this time. "Why do you boast about your crimes, great warrior? Doeg, great warrior, Saul. Do you realize God's justice continues forever? You love to destroy others, but God will strike you down. But I am like an olive tree thriving in the house of God, and I will always trust in God's unfailing love." And so what does David do? And what do we do in the face of these awful, evil acts? David says, this is terrible. He allows it to affect him. And what else does David do? He says, "You know what, God? I know that we live in a world where you allow free will and where you allow evil to happen for a time. However, your justice is eternal. And one day, you will make this right. And what we can say with confidence is every evil act perpetrated in this world, God will make it right someday. God will bring about justice. And that justice will be in one of two forms. Either the punishment for that person's sin will be poured out onto Christ on the cross, or that person will take the punishment themselves. That's the question God has for you. Do you want to pay for your own crimes, your own sins, or do you want Christ to pay for that for you? Because Jesus says, I will take your place." But God is a God of justice. And even though now it seems like things are out of control, it seems like evil is running rampant, we know this is temporary. And we know that God will bring about justice someday. And God will create a world where there is nothing like this anymore. Well, in 1 Samuel 23, news comes to David. The Philistines were at Keilah, an Israelite city. And David asked Yahweh. We see David pray, "God, should I go and attack? I'm running from Saul, but should I go and rescue other innocent people being attacked by the Philistines?" And God says, "Yes, go and save Keilah." And so David moves into Keilah, this time not fleeing, but this time navigating around Saul and going to save the citizens of this town. Well, Saul soon learned that David was at Keilah. David wins the victory. They stay at Keilah for a time, but then Saul hears he's there, and so Saul mobilizes his army. He's going to the town, and David gets a funny feeling. He learns about Saul's plan, and he wonders, are these people going to turn me in? And so what does he do? He prays to God again. He prayed, oh, Yahweh, will Saul actually come up here? And God says, yeah, he's coming. And he says, again, he prays, will these people betray us after all that we've done for them? And God says, yeah, actually, they will betray you. He's a God who knows the future. Nothing's going to surprise him. And these people in Keilah, they must have known, maybe they heard about the massacre at Nob. They don't want to be the next people on Saul's hit list. And so, as it turns out, they're going to turn him in. And David has to flee again. He flees for a seventh time to the region of Ziph. He stayed in the hill country of Ziph. And one day, again, David receives news that Saul is on the way. And I don't know how many years we are into this. This hiding and running and hiding and running. But he hears Saul's coming for him. But you know who shows up? You know who finds him first? He gets a visit from his good buddy Jonathan. Jonathan went to find David. And Jonathan encouraged David to stay strong in his faith in God. He said, David, don't be afraid. He says, God has made a promise to you. And you are going to be king someday. And you and I, we're going to be right there together. And they renewed their pact of friendship. What a delight to get a visit from an old friend, encouragement from an old friend when things are really rough. This is what God gave David here. But now the men of Ziph, they went to Saul and they betrayed David to him. Another betrayal. We know where David's hiding, they told Saul. Yahweh bless you, Saul said. At last, someone is concerned about me. And so David has to run again. He runs away from Ziph. And how does he deal with these betrayals? We see more psalms written during this time in David's life. We see David again going to God and pouring his heart out to God. You would think you'd do this once and you're good. But he keeps getting scared. He keeps having to go back down through the truth of God. Psalm 54, come with great power, O God, and rescue me. Defend me with your might. Listen to my prayer, O God. There's violent people out there trying to kill me. But God is my helper. God is the one who keeps me alive. And so again, we see David bringing his trauma to God, bringing his emotions to God, and coming back down to that place of peace, that place of confidence. You've got to learn how to go to God in these difficult times and come out on the other side with that peace, with that stability. Well, in 1 Samuel 23, it says David and his men moved into the wilderness of Maon. Okay, and again, this is a dry, arid land, and this is some of the roughest territory that David was hiding out in. There are caves throughout this area, but water is scarce, and the sun is hot, and it's dry. David flees to Maon, and Saul keeps after him in the wilderness, hunting him down like an animal. Saul and David are now on opposite sides of a mountain, and Saul is working his way around the mountain. They're hunting David. They're tracking him down. And just as they're about to close in, a message comes in. The Philistines are raiding Israel again, and Saul is pulled away from David. And David uses this opportunity to flee to En Gedi, an area down by the Dead Sea, one of the hottest, most arid, lifeless places in the world. You see canyon after canyon like this. However, when you get to En Gedi, you see the trees along there. That's a very rare sight in an area of the Dead Sea. And you see lush waterfalls. You see sources of water and plenty of caves to hide in. This would have been a good place for David to go. He flees to En Gedi and figures we can kind of wait it out here. Saul, however, hears that David is in En Gedi. And he chooses 3,000 elite troops from all Israel. And he goes down to search for David. As at the place where the road passes some sheepfolds, Saul decides it's time to take a dump. He says, gentlemen, wait right here. The king has business. He decides to go into a cave to relieve himself. So he's got his little shovel to, you know, dig it up, bury it, right? goes into that dark cave, takes off his robe, goes over there to start to do his business. What he doesn't realize is this cave goes back pretty far. And he's not the only one in that cave. As it happened, David and his men were hiding in that very cave further back. And you know, they're already in there. Their eyes are adjusted to the light. They hear a guy making his way in there and they're like, oh my gosh, it's Saul. This is our chance. Now's your opportunity, David. Here's this man who's ordered the massacre of so many. This man who's made David's life miserable for years. This man who should not be king. David is the rightful king. He's been anointed. Today they told David, God's telling you, I'll put your enemy in your power. You can do whatever you want to him. And so David crept forward and he draws his sword. And it says he cuts a piece from Saul's robe where it was lying a little ways away from wherever Saul was doing his thing. Well, Saul puts his robe back on. He doesn't notice the piece is missing. Saul goes out of the cave. He begins to go on his way. He's probably down the hill and maybe up the other side of the valley, a safe distance away. And David comes out and he shouts after him, my lord, the king! Saul turns around. He can't believe his eyes. There, standing in that cave, is David, the cave that he's just exited. Why do you listen to the people who say I'm trying to harm you? This very day you can see with your own eyes. It's not true. He holds up the piece of the robe. He tells them how the men wanted me to kill you. And I said, no, you're the Lord's anointed. I will not raise my hand against God's anointed. And Saul listens to David's lengthy speech. 5, 6, 7 verses. He says, David says, Yahweh placed you at my mercy back there in the cave. Some of my men told me to kill you, but I spared you. I will never harm the king. He is Yahweh's anointed one. And Saul, when David had finished speaking, Saul said, is that really you, my son David? He began to cry. This is a man who was right on the edge of sanity. You're a better man than I am. You repaid me good for evil. And I surely realize you're going to be king. And the king is going to do so much better with you as king and flourish under your rule. And then Saul went home. But David and his men went back to the stronghold. Just because somebody cries doesn't mean they're sorry. Sometimes it just means they got caught. Just sometimes it means they're going crazy. Well, 1 Samuel 25:1, we read about the death of Samuel. And all Israel gathered for his funeral, but of course, David can't go to that funeral because he's a man on the run. And the years are rolling by, and he will never see Samuel again in this life. And David then moved into the wilderness of Maon, a place where he was before, where something very significant happens to him. David flees to Maon. And there was a wealthy man from Maon. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. That's how they measured wealth back then. And it was sheep shearing time. And you know, sheep shearing time is the time where, you know, not only do you shear the sheep, but you often kill the sheep. You have a harvest. It's kind of the end of the sheep season. It's time for the sheep harvest. And this man's name was Nabal, and that word means dumbass, literally. It means fool, okay? The man's name was Nabal, and his wife, Abigail, was a sensible and beautiful woman. You don't always have both of those. Sometimes you have neither. She was wise and beautiful. Probably forced into marriage with Nabal against her will. But Nabal, a descendant of Caleb, was crude and mean in all of his dealings. He's still from the same tribe as David. And as it turns out, David and his men had been basically security guards for Nabal and all of his shepherds throughout the entire season where these sheep and goats were growing. And when David heard Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent 10 of his young men with a message. And he said, look, we've been on guard duty for months now. I wonder if you could kind of kick back a little bit our way. I wonder if you could hook us up for all the good that we've done for you over the past several months. Nabal wanted nothing to do with it. Who is this fellow David? He sneered to the young men. Why should I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to a band of outlaws who come from who knows where? Well, David's young men returned and told him what Nabal had said. Get your swords, was David's reply as he strapped on his own sword. And then 400 men started off with David, ready to do some war on Nabal. So David, you know, it's like he's holding together so much, not striking out against Saul. And now this is like the final straw. And again, they've been out in the wilderness for years now. Things are reaching a breaking point for David. And he's had enough, and he just snaps. His anger, he loses control. Meanwhile, one of Nabal's servants went to Abigail and told her, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master. He screamed insults at them, Abigail. These men, David's men, they've been very good to us. Day and night, they were like a wall of protection. Well, Abigail, being a wise woman, wasted no time. She quickly gathered 200 loaves of bread, 2 wineskins full of wine, 5 sheep that had been slaughtered, as well as several other fruits. Loads them all up on a caravan and heads out to meet David. As she was riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, she saw David and his men coming toward her. She looks up and there's a caravan of retribution heading their way. Behind her is a caravan of reconciliation with food for the men. Here is wise, wonderful Abigail caught between angry men and trying to navigate her way in a world that didn't think too highly of women. Sorry, ladies. And when Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed low before him. Here is a present that I, your servant, have brought to you. And she presents all of the food. She begins apologizing for her husband. She's like, his name is Dumbass, and you know, well, there's a reason for that. I'm so sorry. I apologize on behalf of our whole family. And David, don't let this be a blemish on your record. Don't do something stupid in your anger. And when Yahweh has done these great things for you, please, will you remember me, your servant, wise, beautiful Abigail? How great to have someone step in when you're furious and keep you from doing something you're really going to regret. David's going to do a lot of the things in his life he'll regret. This is not one of them, thanks to Abigail. David replied to Abigail, praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, who has sent you to meet me today. Thank God for your good sense, Abigail. May God bless you for keeping me from murder. This wonderful, beautiful woman who's come out to meet me, who obviously has a lot of money. And I mentioned that I'm single. Saul gave my wife away to some other guy. And I've been in the wilderness for a long time. It's too bad you're married to that fool. Well, if things don't work out between you guys, maybe we'll see each other again someday. Return home in peace, Abigail. And so she heads back home. She found her husband was throwing a big party. He was super drunk. She wasn't going to talk to him in that state. In the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him what had happened. And he was so shocked by the news. As a result, he had a stroke. 10 days later, Nabal was dead, and Abigail was single. And David sent messengers to Abigail to ask her to become his wife. And she bowed low to the ground and responded, I, your servant, would be happy to marry King David. All right. There's a lot there. We're talking a decade or more of David's life. We're talking hard duty. We're talking in the wilderness, not sure where your next meal is going to come from, sleeping on the ground, in a lot of pain. We're talking witness to horrible evils. We're talking, where is God? God anointed him when he was a teenager. And now he's 30? And still, this hasn't happened? David is waiting on God. And there's a lot we can learn about that. When the weeks become months for you, and the months become years, what are you going to do? Will you take things into your own hands? Or will you actively wait on God? Waiting on God is not a passive thing. David was anything but passive throughout this time. We see him restraining himself from attacking Saul, even though he could have. We see him fleeing. We see him moving around. We see him moving in and doing good when he can to protect innocent townspeople. We see him leaving and retreating. We see him praying again and again. We see him praying in the Psalms. We see him praying in the narrative. God did a lot of work in David's life through this time. David could not have become the king that he was had he not gone through this period of waiting. And so if you're waiting on God, will you do like David? Will you trust God to bring spiritual friends just when the time is right? And will you accept the friends that God puts into your life? David wasn't like, no, I want Jonathan. No, I want Samuel. God brought him these new people. And maybe they weren't the people that society would have liked. They weren't necessarily the people he would have hung out with. And yet they became dear friends of his. They became his best friends. They became his brothers in arms. We see him even bringing David's family back into the picture and God doing healing there. We see them becoming a spiritual friends. Waiting on God, David does not repay evil with evil, but he repays evil with good. Can you do that while you're waiting on God? Will you lash out at those who you feel like have brought this pain into your life? Or will you do what Jesus says? Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. When Jesus said, if they strike you on the one cheek, will you turn the other one? We're called on to forgive. We're called on to love. And David was trusting God to raise him up to the throne when the time was right. He was confident that God would, and he didn't want to get there by his own hand. Repeatedly seeking God's comfort in prayer. How many of us are simply stewing in our own thoughts and feeling sorry for ourselves? No, you're missing out on a wonderful opportunity to grow deeper in your relationship with God. God wants to use this trial in your life. God wants to use this time of waiting to draw you close to him. Will you turn to him? Will you come to God and not just speak the truth, but to tell your feelings to God? To really be honest with God and then to move to the truth. We've got to have both. We've got to have the feelings and we've got to have the truth. And we see this in psalm after psalm, time after time. When David was scared, when he was overwhelmed, when he was angry, he turns to God for comfort. He turns to God for guidance. And that image, he says, I'm taking shelter under your wings. It's such a tender image. Let that sink in. Tell God, I want to have that with you. And finally, as we wait on God, we need to remember the times that God has come through. Why do you think David wrote all these down? Because when God comes through and the waiting is over, it's hard to remember what it felt like. It's hard to remember how difficult that was. And what we have in David's life is we have a record of the faithfulness of God, a record that he shares with us. Will you remember the times God has come through? Even if he's not coming through now, you can look back on those other times. And you can trust that he will someday. He will keep his promises just like he's kept his promises in the past. And when you gain security and stability and peace through that. And that is David on the run. Lord, I suspect some of us here, we're having to wait on you right now. And we're in pain, God. And I want to pray for those people right now, Lord. I pray that they would turn to you in that pain, that they would talk to the God who loves, the God who cares, the God who listens, Lord, the God who loved enough to send his one and only son. I pray, God, that you would give those people patience here tonight, Lord, that you'd give them a sense of your peace, that you'd give them a sense of comfort. I pray, Lord, that they would learn how to talk to you in a way that's real, and that they would learn to love that, Lord, that they would grow closer in their relationship with you, and they would grow more engaged emotionally while also being more centered on truth. And I pray, Lord, that you would give us endurance, Lord, those of us who are waiting. Give us endurance to hang in there, Lord, not to lash out at those who we feel like are causing the pain in our life, but instead to repay evil with good and kindness like you did with us. And Lord, I pray most of all for those who have never come to know the God who picks the trash out of the garbage heap and sets them in places of honor, Lord. I pray they would know that. I pray they would receive your forgiveness and your loving hand in their lives tonight, God. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.